This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com.
Philosophy Bites is made in association with the Institute of Philosophy.
In the past decade, there have been several polemical and best-selling books by atheists about, as they see it, the intellectual bankruptcy and malign influence of religion. In the West, society is slowly becoming more secular, a trend these authors welcome. But Alain de Botton, philosopher and author of several international bestsellers, fears that we're in danger of losing what's valuable in religious culture and practice. So he's written a book, Religion for Atheists.
Alain de Botton, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Thank you.
The topic we're going to focus on this time is Atheism 2.0. Most people won't know what that is, so could you just give a brief sketch of what you think this Atheism 2.0 is?
Well, in recent years, say for about the last 15 years, to be an atheist has meant primarily thinking not just that religion is wrong, but that it's ridiculous. There's been a mocking tone on the part of many thinkers. They've pointed out the absurdities of religion, and there's a long tradition in philosophy of that. Clever Sparks, just taking you through every single absurdity, miracles, transubstantiation, etc. This is all well and good, but it doesn't interest me at all. I am an atheist, but the idea of spending any time trying to disprove anybody else's belief holds no charm. What interests me is a very basic question. What is there within religion that might interest me as an atheist? Lots is of no value. Nevertheless, I'm fascinated by certain sides of religion, primarily the organizational sides of religion, not the doctrines, how religions go about organizing themselves, how they take us through a day, their rituals, their communal aspects, their educational aspects, how they organize pilgrimages, feasts, and that is what Atheism 2.0 is about.
Well, could you give an example then of something that's valuable? A lot of atheists listening to this will say everything that's valuable about life you can get without the religious premises.
Well, one area that I'm interested in is education, how people learn. In the modern secular world, we have this view of education that so long as an argument is reasonable and good, if you put it to somebody, they will remember it for the rest of their life. Religions assume that if you tell someone something that's very convincing and very interesting, they will forget it probably in the next 20 minutes. So you need to keep repeating it. The ancient Greeks had this wonderful word, akrasia, weakness of will. Arguments and positions can be very interesting and convincing, but we all suffer from weakness of will. And to combat weakness of will, you need training, mental training. A lot of what I'm interested in is the effectiveness of religion. These guys don't have the great ideas, I don't think, but goodness, they are very effective. I can't help but be interested in how these people are getting their ideas across. One of the ways is through techniques of repetition, but also rhetoric. Classic thing of religions is they know that how you speak is deeply important. Again, we've devalued this. If you look at the university system, it doesn't place much emphasis on this.
What about the relationship with the body and learning? It seems to me that many religious traditions don't have, as you might have expected, this huge separation between spirituality and the body. They actually involve the body in various ritualistic ways in the process of learning and meditating.
Yes, this is deeply fascinating to me. The more I looked at religions, the more I thought they stand out next to secular societies in the way that they believe that our minds have to be affected and are affected by our senses, by our bodies, you could broadly say, and that if you're trying to get someone on board, you have to involve the whole self. Probably the most developed version of this comes in Buddhism. And so if you look at things like Zen Buddhist approach to chanting, to breathing, to meditation, or even a more quaint ceremony like the Zen Buddhist tea ceremony, what you've got there is an attempt to make a philosophical lesson about the impermanence of life vivid through a beverage. By imbibing a drink in a certain way, you will make that lesson stick because of a sympathy, a sort of synesthetic sympathy between the drink and the lesson. And to some extent, all religions have this. They pick out foods, they pick out sounds, they pick out colours, they involve architecture to touch the whole self. And it's just striking how much in secular society we've totally divided this.
But don't you lose all the sense of spirituality? I'm thinking somebody goes through a ritualistic pouring of wine into a particular kind of fine glass and drinks in a certain sort of minimalist way because that is the culture that they're in. That's very different from somebody performing a religious ritual around drink.
Look, you're right. Religion provides a certain force and a resonance which atheists might be forever cut off from. However, I think there's still something available. We don't need to throw the whole thing out if we happen not to believe in certain doctrines.
So what about this thorny thing of spirituality? Atheists are often accused of a kind of blunt approach to life because they lack spirituality. They don't really experience the world in a way a religious person does. And when an atheist says, oh, but I do have the equivalent of spiritual experiences in relation to works of art or beauty in nature, the religious person says, no, you only think you do.
I think that atheists have at their fingertips all sorts of possibilities to get in touch with feelings that are not religious, but close to what religions promote. I discuss this whole idea of perspective. A lot of what's consoling about religion is that you adopt a new perspective on yourself and on your life, as it were, a cosmic perspective, a perspective where in both space and time you are reduced in importance. And that tends to be a very satisfactory emotion. But I think this is still very open to non-believers. So if you read Spinoza's view of looking at yourself from the perspective of eternity, from the stars, that's very close to what the book of Job tells you. When God tells Job, do you know how the earth was formed? You know, can you measure the earth, etc.? What Job is essentially being told is, look at your problems by a cosmic perspective. I think that science often doesn't frame itself to bring out its therapeutic aspects. And I'm getting more interested in the idea that science has a value, an aesthetic value. You don't need much knowledge of scientific puzzles to derive from science quite a lot of the aesthetic or psychological benefit that's there. I take my children to the Science Museum quite often. When we go to the Science Museum, we're not really interested in exactly when the dinosaurs died out or exactly which bird evolved from whatever. What we take away is a very general message, something like, gosh, human beings are very small in a vast universe that's been around a hell of a long time. It's almost like the only way that we can allow ourselves to be interested in natural phenomena is as scientists, rather than allowing ourselves to derive the didactic message that is implicit in science, but that scientists are a little bit worried to talk about. They think this is too close to religion.
What about art as a substitute for religion? Because many people have an almost reverential approach to great works of art.
Well, we hear all the time, don't we, that museums are our new churches and that art is the new religion. I think that's a nice idea, but art is not delivering on that. And the reason it's not delivering on that is that it's in hoc to a modernist idea that good art is not didactic and good art is elusive and ambiguous and does not want to do anything with you. And I guess I'm struck by the Christian approach to art, which is really very simple. You should use art to become good and to avoid evil. And works of art, however great, however complex they are as works of art, at the level of their moral message, have that extreme simplicity. And I think that simplicity is something we're very afraid of, perhaps because modern works of art at a technical level are quite simple. So if you had a work of art that was technically simple and simple at its level of its message, that would be too threatening to the exclusivity of the world of art. So many modern artists, particularly those who don't have much craft behind them, really run away from being too clear about what they're trying to do.
Maybe it's a dogma, but it is certainly a belief of many people in the arts that didacticism is usually the recipe for failure as art.
Totally. To which my only answer is Titian. This was a very great artist with an extremely simple moral set of messages. Most of Western art is essentially didactic art with very simple things. You know, what's the point of that Bellini? It's to get you to appreciate the tenderness of the Virgin Mary. That doesn't stop it being an extremely accomplished and complex technical creation. There are many works of contemporary modern art that have messages, but these are not brought out. I'm interested in changing the frame. If I was rehanging Tate Modern Gallery in London, I'd keep the collection. Nothing wrong with the collection, but I would change the headings. Art is still tends to be displayed by period or by style or by a genre. Compare that to what a temple is or a church is. You know, a church mingles all kinds of works of art and aligns these works to moral messages. So you can have, you know, a piece of sculpture and a photograph and a this or a that. Because what they're trying to do is, you know, in this niche, we're talking about maternal love. And in that wing, we're talking about sacrifice. You know, if you look at something like the Stations of the Cross, tradition of the Stations of the Cross, you're using art to go on a journey so that by the end of the journey, you'll be slightly different from the person you were at the beginning. It's possible to do that with secular art. It would be possible.
But if you did that with an artist like Rothko, you're going to end up with something that's going to look crude. You're going to say, this is somebody who shows you how dark the human condition is, but perhaps carries some sort of message for salvation through absorption into the wider world of human relationships. It's going to be a crude summary, whereas the experience of the works for most people is more complex than that.
I don't know. I'm very sympathetic to people who come out of contemporary museums very puzzled. And they'll go to Rothko and they'll see the caption and they'll see that this was an American artist who was influenced by X and Y and Z. And then we'll sit down on a bench and we'll essentially not know what to do. To say to them, this is a room where the darkest thoughts about you and your life, allow them to express themselves, feel them. It's a suggestion. It's not an order and it's not a limit to what this work could do. It's a hint. And it's probably a much better hint than to be told that Rothko was born in 1942, or whatever, wherever he was.
The categories you've talked about in relation to art are actually mostly moral categories, or they relate to moral psychology. Obviously, religions have at their heart some kind of view about how you should live. What can secular people learn from a religion, though?
Look, my sense of the modern world is that it's a world that is slightly, in a paranoid way, obsessed with freedom. The Western world has spent the last 200 years raising the level of freedom. That's been the watchword of all political theorists and activists. And they had a job to do, and a legitimate job to do. My sense is that we've gone a bit too far. We now have freedom. The individual is now not going to be told how to live. We are free to mess up our lives as we will. And we're also free to succeed, but we're also free to fail. And I argue that suggestions on how we might live, reminders of the right way to live, optimal ways to live, good ways to live, are not necessarily always limits to freedom. That our obsession with not being told what to do can cut us off from rather good ideas about what we might do. There's a refusal to accept that we might, at certain times, willingly want to have certain possibilities of which we're capable cut off from us. And we might willingly cede our freedom for the sake of something else, fulfilment or greater effectiveness or whatever. So the model of the human being which secular society is working with is one that is unfairly paranoid about influence. And I can't help but be interested in the way that religions can see a value in reminding people of ways that they want to live.
When most religions formulate the laws, these are supposed to be coming from God, though, and that gives you quite a strong incentive to curb your behaviour. Without the backing of some authority figure like God, what force can these injunctions have on us?
I think they still can have a lot of force. If somebody says, try to be good, or don't get angry so much, or whatever, that has an impact. And it has an impact because I agree with the suggestion. It's just that that suggestion has a habit of disappearing unless it's in the ether. A moral atmosphere can be terribly helpful in just reminding us of ways in which we want to behave but frequently don't behave. We've just been through Christmas recently. Now, as an atheist, I have many complaints with Christmas, but often around Christmas there's a suggestion that this is a season in which you might try that little bit harder to be kind. And when we all try to be hard to be kind, we are actually kind. And we normally think, oh, that's such a really good thing to be. But we needed that incentive of Christmas. So Christmas is an excuse to get us to do something that we already wanted to do, but were too weak, back to a crazier, were too weak-willed or too forgetful to do the rest of the year.
What about the criticism that all you're doing is picking from this spiritual buffet the things that you happen to like? They're not really grounded in anything. They're just your own particular favourite flavours. Isn't that what you're doing?
Absolutely. That is unashamedly what I'm doing. And I'm very happy to defend that. If that criticism comes from a religious person, they're saying, look, get away from our religion unless you're going to sign up to it. If you sign up to it, you can have the whole thing, but don't just come along and nab the best bits. I can accept that from a religious person. But if a non-religious person says, look, what are you doing picking the best bits? I would go, well, don't you do this with literature? Don't you do this with music? Don't you do this with art? We naturally do this of disciplines. It would be like someone saying, look, I quite like the work of Virginia Woolf. And somebody saying, you can't like the work of Virginia Woolf unless you read the whole thing and accept every part of it and reject everything else. We naturally see that there are the best bits of Virginia Woolf, which will marry up with the best bits of Dr. Johnson or whatever. And we have no problem doing that. And in a sense, a selective path is utterly valid.
Alan de Botton, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's now a Philosophy Bites book published by Oxford University Press. For more information, go to www.philosophybites.com.
For more information about the Institute, go to www.philosophy.sas.ac.uk.